The vox caster crackled to life once again, dragging me from the shallow sleep that passed for rest in the Arbites precinct. Three murders in Hive Tertius's under Hive, each more grotesque than standard gang violence. I pulled on my carapace armor and checked my bolt pistol's ammunition counter, knowing the descent into the under Hive would offer no guarantees of return. The precinct's duty sergeant briefed me with the disinterested tone of a man who had seen too many corpses. The first body had been discovered in Hab Block Gamma 7, wedged between rusted support struts in what used to be a residential sector. The second turned up three levels down in an abandoned Prometheum storage facility. The third victim was found in a collapsed chapel dedicated to the Emperor, though the iconography had been defaced beyond recognition decades ago. What made these murders different from the usual underhive carnage was the precision. Each victim bore intricate carvings carved into their flesh with surgical accuracy. The wounds showed no signs of ritual scarification, common among the various cults that festered in the lower levels. These weren't gang markings or territorial disputes. Someone had taken considerable time and effort to create what could only be described as artwork on human skin. I descended through the maze of maintenance shafts and service tunnels that connected the upper levels to the underhive proper. The air grew thick with industrial pollutants and the stench of human waste. Flickering lumens cast dancing shadows on walls covered in decades of grime and graffiti. The deeper I went, the more the architecture changed from imperial standard to jury-rigged expansions built by desperate people with salvaged materials. Hab Block Gamma 7 squatted like a tumor between two massive support pillars. The structure had been expanded upward and outward over the years, creating a precarious tower of welded metal plates and reinforced plasteel. I found the crime scene cordoned off with warning tape that had already been torn and trampled by curious locals. The victim had been a middle-aged man, probably a factory worker based on the chemical burns on his hands and the worn condition of his clothing. He hung suspended between two support beams, arms spread wide and secured with industrial cable. The killer had stripped him naked and begun work on his torso, creating a pattern that resembled flowing water or perhaps wind currents. The cuts were shallow enough to avoid major arteries, designed to prolong suffering rather than cause quick death. I examined the wounds more closely with my magnification lenses. Each incision showed the same depth and angle, suggesting the killer had used some kind of guide or template. The edges were clean, indicating a very sharp blade, possibly a Medicae scalpel or similar precision instrument. More disturbing was the evidence that the victim had been kept alive throughout the process. Stress patterns in the surrounding tissue and the way blood had coagulated indicated hours of conscious torture. The second crime scene in the Prometheum facility presented similar findings, but with a different artistic approach. This victim, a young woman with the pale complexion common among underhive dwellers, had been arranged on a makeshift altar constructed from empty fuel drums. The carvings on her body formed geometric patterns that seemed to shift and flow when viewed from different angles. The killer had taken even more time with this victim, creating layers of cuts that intersected and overlapped in complex ways. What struck me most was the complete absence of any practical motive. The victims retained their possessions, meager as they were. Their clothing showed no signs of sexual assault. The killer had taken nothing and left nothing behind except the bodies themselves, transformed into canvases for his twisted artistry. The third scene in the ruined chapel confirmed my growing suspicions. The victim, an elderly man who might have been a scavenger or recycler, had been positioned before the defaced altar with his arms raised as if in supplication. The carvings covered his entire body in a pattern that resembled flames or perhaps screaming faces, depending on the viewing angle. The level of anatomical knowledge required to create such intricate designs without immediately killing the subject suggested medical training or extensive practice. I spent hours documenting each scene with my picked recorder, noting the positions, the wound patterns, and the environmental details. The killer had chosen locations that offered privacy, but also symbolic significance. Each site had once served the community in some capacity, housing, industry, worship, before decay and abandonment claimed them. The local Arbites precinct commander made his priorities clear when I requested additional resources. Underhive murders ranked low on the priority list unless they threatened Upper Hive stability or involved valuable assets. Three dead Underhivers, regardless of the circumstances, did not warrant significant manpower allocation. I would have to work with minimal support and rely on local contacts for information. My first informant was a former ganger named Vex, who operated a black market augmetic repair shop in the industrial sector. He had survived long enough in the Underhive to develop an extensive network of contacts and an acute sense of when unusual activities were taking place in his territory. Vex confirmed that word of the murders was spreading through the Underhive communities, creating an atmosphere of paranoia and suspicion. According to Vex, the killer moved through the Underhive tunnel systems with remarkable knowledge of the layout. The distances between crime scenes would normally require several days of careful navigation for someone unfamiliar with the area. The killer had managed to traverse these routes while carrying the tools and materials necessary for his work, suggesting either extensive preparation or intimate familiarity with the Underhive geography. The local enforcers proved less helpful than my criminal contacts. Most were either corrupt, incompetent, or both. The few honest ones were overwhelmed by the constant violence and disorder that plagued their beats. They had neither the time nor the resources to investigate murders that didn't directly threaten their own survival or that of their informants. I interviewed residents near each crime scene, though most were reluctant to speak with an arbitrator. The Underhive operated on its own codes of conduct, and cooperation with Imperial authority was often seen as betrayal. Those who did speak provided conflicting accounts of suspicious activities. Some reported seeing figures moving through the shadows at unusual hours. Others mentioned strange sounds emanating from abandoned sections of their hab blocks. One pattern emerged from these fragmented testimonies. Several witnesses mentioned a figure carrying what appeared to be a medical case or tool kit. The descriptions varied in details, but consistently mentioned someone moving with purpose through areas that most Underhivers avoided. This suggested the killer was either fearless or possessed knowledge that allowed him to navigate safely through territories controlled by hostile gangs. The forensic evidence painted a picture of methodical planning and execution. The killer brought his own tools and materials to each scene. He had studied the locations in advance, identifying the best positions for his work and the most effective methods for restraining his victims. The surgical precision of the cuts indicated not just medical knowledge, but also significant practice in applying that knowledge to unwilling subjects. As I compiled my findings, the scope of the investigation became clear. I was hunting someone with advanced medical training, extensive knowledge of Underhive geography, and access to high-quality surgical instruments. The killer possessed the physical strength and psychological disposition necessary to overpower victims and torture them for extended periods. Most disturbing of all, he appeared to be motivated purely by artistic expression rather than any comprehensible goal. The absence of ritual elements ruled out most cult activity. The lack of gang markings eliminated territorial disputes. The preservation of valuables eliminated robbery as a motive. What remained was the possibility that someone was killing Underhive residents simply because he could, transforming their bodies into expressions of his own twisted creativity. I requested access to Medicaid facility records and personnel files, hoping to identify individuals with the necessary skills and opportunity. The response from the administratum was predictably slow and bureaucratic. Background checks on medical personnel required approval from multiple departments, each with their own procedures and timelines. While waiting for official channels to produce results, I continued my investigation through less conventional means. The Underhive contained numerous unlicensed Medicaid practitioners who served the population without imperial sanction. Many were former military medics, failed medical students, or individuals who had acquired their skills through necessity rather than formal training. My search led me deeper into the Underhive's hidden economy of illegal services and black market goods. I discovered networks of individuals who provided medical care, performed augmetic installations, and even conducted crude surgical procedures in conditions that would horrify any sanctioned Medicaid facility. Most operated out of desperation or greed, but a few seemed driven by more complex motivations. The investigation consumed days of careful questioning and discreet observation. I mapped the social networks that connected various illegal medical practitioners, looking for individuals who possessed both the necessary skills and the psychological profile to commit such elaborate murders. The work was tedious and dangerous, requiring me to navigate the complex territorial disputes and social hierarchies that governed underhive society. Each lead seemed to branch into multiple possibilities, creating an ever-expanding web of potential suspects and connections. The killer's knowledge of anatomy suggested formal training, but his willingness to torture innocent civilians indicated a complete break from medical ethics. This combination of professional competence and moral depravity narrowed the field considerably, but still left numerous possibilities. The breakthrough came from an unexpected source. A black market organ dealer mentioned rumors of someone purchasing unusual quantities of surgical supplies through intermediaries. The purchases included high-grade scalpels, precision cutting tools, and medical restraints, exactly the equipment that would be necessary for the kind of work I had observed at the crime scenes. The organ dealer's information led me through a maze of black market contacts, each transaction carefully obscured through layers of intermediaries and false identities. The surgical supplies had been purchased over several months, always in small quantities to avoid attracting attention. The buyer had paid an untraceable scrip and used different pickup locations throughout the Underhive's commercial sectors. I traced the supply chain through three separate vendors before finding one willing to provide more detailed information. The merchant operated out of a converted storage container in the industrial quarter, selling everything from basic medical supplies to military-grade combat stims. He remembered the transactions because the buyer had been unusually specific about the quality and specifications of the instruments requested. According to the vendor, the purchaser had demonstrated extensive knowledge of surgical equipment, asking detailed questions about blade composition, handle ergonomics, and edge retention. The buyer had rejected several offerings as inadequate, insisting on instruments that met exacting standards. This level of expertise suggested someone with significant experience using such tools in professional settings. The fourth crime scene appeared 2 days later in Sector Mortis, a sprawling maze of abandoned manufactorums and collapsed residential blocks. The victim had been discovered by a group of scavengers searching for salvageable materials in what remained of a textile processing facility. They had fled immediately after finding the body, but word spread quickly through the Underhive's informal communication networks. I arrived at the scene within 6 hours of the discovery, though the scavengers had already contaminated much of the surrounding area. The killer had chosen a location deep within the facility's interior, far from any regular foot traffic or patrol routes. The victim, a woman in her 30s with the calloused hands of a manual laborer, had been secured to a massive industrial loom that dominated the center of the workspace. The carvings on her body represented a significant escalation in complexity and ambition. The killer had created an intricate pattern that seemed to tell a story across the surface of her skin. Starting at her shoulders, the cuts formed flowing lines that spiraled down her arms and across her torso, creating the impression of movement frozen in flesh. The level of detail was extraordinary, with smaller cuts intersecting and complementing the larger patterns to create depth and texture. The anatomical precision had improved dramatically since the earlier murders. The killer had learned to work around major blood vessels and nerve clusters, prolonging the victim's consciousness while avoiding premature death. Stress patterns in the tissue indicated she had remained alive for most of the carving process, experiencing every cut with full awareness. What disturbed me most was the evidence of the killer's growing confidence. The earlier murders had shown signs of hesitation and experimentation, but this latest work demonstrated complete mastery of the technique. The cuts were deeper and more elaborate, the positioning more dramatic, and the overall composition more sophisticated. The killer was not just practicing his craft, but actively refining and improving it. The fifth crime scene appeared 3 days later in the ruins of a water reclamation plant. The facility had been abandoned for decades after a catastrophic failure flooded several lower levels and contaminated the local water supply. Most underhivers avoided the area due to persistent chemical residues and unstable structural conditions. The victim was a young man, probably in his early 20s, with the lane build common among underhive runners and message carriers. The killer had positioned him in the center of the main processing chamber, suspended from overhead pipes in a pose that suggested flight or ascension. The carvings covered his entire body in a pattern that resembled feathers or scales, each individual element perfectly proportioned and positioned. The technical skill displayed in this murder exceeded anything I had encountered in my years as an arbitrator. The killer had managed to create the illusion of texture and movement using nothing but precisely placed cuts in human flesh. The work required not just anatomical knowledge, but also artistic vision and the steady hands necessary to execute such intricate designs. I spent hours documenting the scene, noting the progression in technique and ambition from the earlier murders. The killer was clearly learning from each experience, refining his methods and expanding his artistic vocabulary. The intervals between murders were also decreasing, suggesting either growing confidence or increasing compulsion to create these grotesque masterpieces. My investigation into the victim profiles revealed a disturbing pattern. None of the five victims had any connection to each other beyond their residence in the underhive. They came from different hab blocks, worked in different industries, and moved in completely separate social circles. The killer was selecting them based on physical characteristics rather than personal relationships or practical considerations. The first victim had possessed the broad shoulders and muscular build, typical of heavy industrial workers. The second had been chosen for her pale skin and delicate bone structure. The third victim's advanced age had provided the killer with different tissue properties to work with. The fourth victim's athletic build had offered new possibilities for artistic expression. The fifth victim's youthful appearance and lean physique had allowed for the most elaborate work yet. The selection criteria suggested the killer viewed potential victims as raw materials for artistic projects rather than human beings with their own lives and relationships. Each murder represented an exploration of different aesthetic possibilities, with the victim's physical attributes determining the specific approach and design elements employed. I interviewed dozens of underhive residents, searching for any witnesses or information about suspicious activities in the areas surrounding the crime scenes. Most were reluctant to speak with an arbitrator, but fear of the killer eventually overcame their distrust of imperial authority. The emerging picture painted by their testimonies was deeply unsettling. Several witnesses reported seeing a figure moving through the underhive during the early morning hours, always alone and always carrying what appeared to be a medical case or tool kit. The descriptions varied in details, but consistently mentioned someone of average height and build, wearing dark clothing that helped them blend into the shadows. The figure moved with purpose and confidence, navigating the treacherous underhive terrain without hesitation or apparent concern for the various dangers that claimed less experienced travelers. More disturbing were the reports of sounds emanating from the areas where bodies were later discovered. Multiple witnesses described hearing what they initially assumed were the cries of injured animals or the groaning of stressed metal structures. Only in retrospect did they realize these sounds might have been human screams, muffled by distance and the acoustic properties of the underhive's industrial architecture. The killer's knowledge of underhive geography was becoming increasingly apparent as I mapped the crime scene locations and the routes between them. The distances involved would normally require several days of careful navigation for someone unfamiliar with the area. The killer was traversing these routes while carrying equipment and potentially unconscious victims, suggesting either extensive preparation or intimate familiarity with the tunnel systems and abandoned structures that honeycombed the lower levels. Local gang leaders proved surprisingly cooperative when I approached them for information. The murders were creating instability in their territories, making their own operations more difficult and dangerous. Several gang bosses had increased security measures and restricted their members' movements in response to the killings. The fear was palpable even among hardened criminals who normally showed little concern for violence or death. One gang leader provided particularly valuable information about the killer's methods. his scouts had discovered evidence of temporary camps in abandoned structures near several crime scenes. The killer was apparently spending considerable time in each area before selecting and acquiring victims. The camps showed signs of careful planning, with supply caches and observation points positioned to provide maximum surveillance of potential targets. The forensic evidence from the crime scenes continued to reveal new details about the killer's techniques and capabilities. Tool mark analysis confirmed that all the carvings had been made with the same set of instruments, suggesting the killer maintained and cared for his equipment with professional attention to detail. The precision of the cuts indicated not just steady hands, but also the ability to work for extended periods without fatigue or loss of concentration. Blood spatter patterns at each scene told the story of prolonged torture sessions lasting many hours. The killer had developed techniques for controlling blood loss while maintaining victim consciousness, allowing him to work on increasingly elaborate designs without losing his canvas to death or unconsciousness. The medical knowledge required for such precise control over human physiology suggested formal training in anatomy and surgical procedures. The psychological profile emerging from my investigation painted a picture of someone completely divorced from normal human empathy or moral constraints. The killer viewed his victims as objects rather than people, raw materials to be shaped according to his artistic vision. The escalating complexity of the murders suggested not just growing skill, but also increasing psychological investment in the work itself. The sixth crime scene appeared in the depths of Sector Umbra, a region so far removed from imperial authority that even the local enforcers rarely ventured into its maze of collapsed tunnels and jury-rigged habitations. The victim had been discovered by a group of waste recyclers who had been exploring a section of abandoned storage facilities in search of salvageable materials. This latest murder represented another significant escalation in both technical complexity and artistic ambition. The killer had chosen a victim with distinctive physical characteristics, a tall woman with unusually long limbs and fingers. The carvings transformed her body into what could only be described as a three-dimensional sculpture, with cuts that created the illusion of movement and flow across the surface of her skin. The positioning was also more elaborate than previous murders. The victim had been arranged in a complex pose that required extensive rigging and support structures. The killer had spent considerable time and effort creating a display that could be viewed from multiple angles, each perspective revealing different aspects of the overall design. The work demonstrated not just medical knowledge, but also understanding of artistic composition and visual impact. What truly disturbed me was the evidence of the killer's growing boldness. This latest murder had taken place in a more accessible location than the previous crimes, suggesting either carelessness or a deliberate desire to increase the visibility of his work. The killer was no longer content to hide his creations in remote locations, but was beginning to display them where they would be discovered more quickly. The time intervals between murders were also decreasing rapidly. The sixth victim had been killed only 2 days after the fifth, compared to the weeks that had separated the earlier crimes. The killer was either losing control of his compulsions or actively accelerating his activities in response to some internal timeline or external pressure. My requests for additional resources and support continued to be denied by the precinct command structure. The murders were classified as low priority incidents that did not warrant significant resource allocation. I was expected to continue the investigation using existing assets and local contacts, despite the clear evidence that the killer posed an escalating threat to Underhive residents. The investigation was consuming all my available time and energy, but I was no closer to identifying the killer than when I had started. The evidence pointed to someone with medical training, extensive knowledge of Underhive geography, and access to high-quality surgical instruments. The psychological profile suggested complete moral detachment and growing artistic ambition. Yet these characteristics could apply to dozens of individuals operating in the Underhive's shadow economy. The breakthrough came from the most unlikely source, a traumatized scavenger named Corvus, who had been found wandering the outer perimeters of Sector Umbra, muttering incoherently about shadows that moved with purpose. The local enforcers had dismissed him as another victim of Underhive madness, but something in his fragmented ramblings caught my attention during a routine sweep of potential witnesses. Corvus had been part of the recycling crew that discovered the sixth victim, but unlike his companions who had fled immediately, he claimed to have lingered long enough to see something that had shattered his already fragile mental state. Between bouts of trembling and incomprehensible babbling, he managed to convey that he had witnessed a figure departing the crime scene through a maintenance access that led deeper into the Underhive's forgotten sectors. The route Corvus described would take someone through the abandoned Manufactorum levels that had been sealed off decades ago following a series of structural collapses and toxic chemical leaks. Most Underhivers considered these areas impassable death traps, but Corvus insisted the figure had moved through them with the confidence of someone intimately familiar with the hazards and safe passages. I spent hours extracting coherent information from Corvus's damaged psyche, piecing together fragments of observation and memory to construct a rough map of the killer's escape route. The path led through a maze of collapsed transit tunnels, abandoned processing facilities, and flooded sub-basements that even the most desperate scavengers avoided. The killer was either suicidal or possessed knowledge that allowed him to navigate these treacherous areas safely. The descent into the forgotten sectors required extensive preparation and specialized equipment. I requisitioned a rebreather unit and portable atmospheric scanner from the precinct's emergency supplies, knowing that the industrial runoff and chemical contamination in the lower levels could prove fatal to unprotected humans. My carapace armor would provide some protection against structural hazards, but the real danger lay in the toxic atmosphere and unstable flooring that characterized these abandoned areas. The access point Corvus had described was located in the ruins of what had once been a major transit hub connecting the upper and lower hive levels. The facility had been abandoned following a catastrophic accident that had killed hundreds of workers and rendered large sections structurally unsound. Decades of neglect had transformed the area into a maze of twisted metal, collapsed concrete, and jury-rigged barriers erected by various groups attempting to salvage useful materials. I entered the ruins through a maintenance shaft that dropped 30 meters into the facility's lower levels. The descent was treacherous, with corroded ladder rungs and unstable support structures that groaned ominously under my weight. The air grew thick with chemical vapors and industrial pollutants that made breathing difficult even through the rebreather's filtration system. The Manufactorum levels stretched out before me like the bones of some massive industrial creature, skeletal remains of production lines and processing equipment casting strange shadows in the flickering light of my luminator. The killer's trail was surprisingly easy to follow once I knew what to look for: disturbed dust patterns, fresh scratches in the corrosion, and the occasional footprint in accumulated chemical residue that coated the floor. The path led through a series of interconnected chambers that had once housed different stages of the manufacturing process. Each room presented new hazards: pools of acidic runoff that had eaten through metal flooring, unstable overhead structures that threatened to collapse at any moment, and toxic gas pockets that triggered warning alerts on my atmospheric scanner. The killer had navigated these dangers with remarkable skill, choosing routes that avoided the worst hazards while maintaining steady progress toward some unknown destination. I followed the trail for what felt like hours, descending ever deeper into the Underhive's industrial graveyard. The architecture grew increasingly alien as I moved through sections that had been modified and expanded by desperate residents over the decades. Makeshift bridges spanned chemical-filled chasms, while jury-rigged platforms provided access to elevated areas where the original walkways had long since collapsed. The killer's knowledge of this labyrinthine environment was becoming increasingly apparent. The route avoided numerous dead ends and hazardous areas that would have trapped or killed an inexperienced explorer. Someone had spent considerable time mapping these tunnels and chambers, identifying safe passages through what appeared to be an impenetrable maze of industrial decay and structural damage. The trail led through a section of collapsed transit tunnels that had been partially flooded with runoff from the upper hive's industrial processes. The water was a sickly yellow-green color that glowed faintly in the darkness, suggesting chemical contamination that would prove fatal to prolonged exposure. The killer had somehow crossed this toxic barrier, leaving traces on the far side that indicated continued movement toward the deeper levels. I managed to traverse the flooded section by following a precarious path along corroded support beams and twisted metal debris. The chemical fumes rising from the contaminated water triggered constant warnings from my atmospheric scanner, forcing me to rely entirely on the rebreather's filtration system. The crossing took nearly an hour of careful navigation, during which any misstep would have resulted in a fatal plunge into the toxic soup below. The killer's trail resumed on the far side of the flooded area, leading through a maze of abandoned storage facilities and processing chambers that stretched deeper into the Underhive's forgotten depths. The industrial equipment in these areas was older and more primitive than what I had encountered in the upper levels, suggesting these facilities had been abandoned for decades or even centuries. I pressed forward through the maze of decaying machinery and collapsed structures, following the subtle signs of the killer's passage through areas that seemed completely impassable. The trail led through ventilation shafts barely wide enough for a human body, across gaps spanned by makeshift bridges constructed from salvaged materials, and through chambers filled with toxic gases that required careful timing to traverse safely. The pursuit was taking a severe toll on my equipment and physical condition. The rebreather's filtration system was struggling with the increasingly toxic atmosphere, while my Luminator's power cell was draining rapidly in the perpetual darkness of the deep Underhive. The carapace armor that normally provided protection and confidence had become a burden in the confined spaces and treacherous terrain. The killer's destination finally became apparent as I emerged into a vast chamber that had once housed a water reclamation facility. The space was dominated by enormous processing tanks and filtration systems that had been abandoned when the facility's operations were relocated to safer areas of the hive. Decades of neglect had transformed the chamber into a cathedral of rust and decay, with twisted pipes and corroded equipment creating a maze of shadows and hiding places. The killer was waiting for me in the center of the chamber, standing beside one of the massive filtration tanks with the calm confidence of someone who had carefully orchestrated this confrontation. The figure matched the descriptions provided by witnesses, average height and build, wearing dark clothing that helped blend into the industrial shadows. A medical case sat open on a nearby surface, revealing an array of surgical instruments that gleamed despite the facility's decrepit condition. The realization that I had been deliberately led into this trap struck me with the force of a physical blow. The killer had known about my investigation from the beginning, had anticipated my methods and responses, and had carefully guided me through the maze of abandoned tunnels to this predetermined location. Every clue I had followed, every witness I had interviewed, every lead I had pursued had been part of an elaborate manipulation designed to bring me here. The killer moved with practiced efficiency, retrieving something from the shadows behind the filtration tank. The object was crude but effective, a length of heavy pipe wrapped in industrial cable to provide a secure grip. The weapon had been positioned in advance, another element of the carefully planned ambush that had drawn me deep into the Underhive's most dangerous sectors. I reached for my bolt pistol, but the killer was already in motion, crossing the distance between us with surprising speed and agility. The makeshift weapon caught me across the side of the head with devastating force, sending stars exploding across my vision and dropping me to my knees on the corroded metal flooring. The impact had been precisely calculated to incapacitate without killing, suggesting the killer had specific plans for my continued survival. The second blow struck the back of my skull as I attempted to rise, driving me face first into the chamber floor with enough force to crack the metal plating beneath me. Consciousness flickered like a damaged Luminator, alternating between awareness and darkness as blood ran down my face and pooled beneath my cheek. The killer's footsteps echoed through the chamber as he moved around my prone form, apparently checking to ensure I was sufficiently incapacitated. The floor beneath me suddenly gave way with a grinding screech of tortured metal, the corroded plating finally succumbing to decades of chemical exposure and structural stress. I plunged through the opening into darkness, my armored body striking pipes and support structures during the fall before landing with bone-jarring impact on something soft and yielding that broke my descent. The stench hit me before my vision cleared, a nauseating combination of human waste, rotting flesh, and chemical contamination that penetrated even the rebreather's filtration system. I had fallen into some kind of collection pit beneath the reclamation facility, a space that had apparently been used as a dumping ground for the facility's organic waste and industrial byproducts. The soft landing that had saved my life revealed itself to be a writhing mass of human bodies in various stages of decay and disease. The pit contained dozens of people, perhaps hundreds, all suffering from terminal illnesses and gangrenous infections that had transformed them into barely recognizable remnants of humanity. They moved with the sluggish persistence of the dying, their diseased flesh sloughing off in chunks as they shifted and crawled over one another in the confined space. The victims were underhive residents who had been discarded like refuse when their conditions became too severe for even the most desperate communities to tolerate. Some suffered from industrial diseases caused by exposure to toxic chemicals, their skin mottled with chemical burns, and their breathing reduced to wet, rattling gasps. Others displayed the advanced stages of various plagues that periodically swept through the underhive's overcrowded hab blocks, their bodies covered in suppurating sores and gangrenous wounds. I struggled to extract myself from the mass of diseased flesh, fighting down waves of nausea as my hands sank into wounds that had become breeding grounds for parasites and infections. The pit's occupants showed little interest in my presence, too consumed by their own suffering to register the arrival of another body in their communal grave. Their eyes were either clouded with disease or had been eaten away entirely by the various infections that consumed their failing bodies. The walls of the pit were smooth metal that offered no handholds or purchase for climbing. The opening through which I had fallen was at least 10 meters above, visible as a rectangle of dim light that seemed impossibly distant. The killer had apparently known about this trap, had deliberately led me to a position where the corroded flooring would give way under the impact of his attack. The diseased occupants of the pit were not merely waiting to die, they were being systematically harvested for some unknown purpose. Fresh surgical incisions marked many of the bodies, precise cuts that had removed organs or tissue samples with the same technical skill I had observed at the murder scenes. The killer had been using this hidden location as a laboratory, experimenting on the terminally ill residents who had been discarded by underhive society. The scope of the killer's activities was far beyond anything I had imagined during my investigation. The elaborate murders that had drawn my attention were merely the visible portion of a much larger operation that had been conducted in secret for months or possibly years. The pit contained evidence of dozens of surgical procedures, each one conducted with the same precision and attention to detail that characterized the artistic murders above. My rebreather's filtration system was failing in the toxic atmosphere of the pit, forcing me to breathe the contaminated air that carried the stench of decay and chemical pollution. The diseased occupants were coughing and wheezing constantly, spreading airborne pathogens that would inevitably compromise my immune system if I remained trapped in this hellish environment for any extended period. The killer's voice echoed down from the opening above, though the words were distorted by distance and the acoustic properties of the metal chamber. The tone was conversational, almost friendly, as if discussing the weather rather than the systematic torture and murder of innocent people. The killer was apparently explaining his methods and motivations, treating me as an audience for his artistic philosophy rather than a threat to be eliminated. The walls of the pit were lined with surgical instruments and medical equipment that had been carefully arranged for easy access during the killer's experiments. Scalpels, bone saws, and various specialized tools hung from hooks and brackets that had been welded to the metal surfaces. The organization and maintenance of the equipment demonstrated the same obsessive attention to detail that characterized the murder scenes above. The diseased bodies beneath me shifted and writhed as I struggled to find purchase on something solid. My armored weight had driven me deep into the mass of rotting flesh, and every movement seemed to sink me further into the putrid morass. The stench was overwhelming even through my failing rebreather, a combination of gangrenous tissue, industrial chemicals, and human waste that made my eyes water and my throat burn. I pressed my hands against what I hoped was solid ground beneath the bodies, only to feel my fingers sink into something soft and yielding that squirmed away from my touch. The pit's occupants were packed so tightly together that distinguishing individual bodies became impossible. Arms and legs intertwined in a grotesque tapestry of diseased flesh, creating a living carpet that undulated with the shallow breathing and involuntary movements of the dying. The walls rose smooth and unbroken around me, constructed from the same corroded metal that characterized the abandoned reclamation facility above. Industrial waste had eaten through the surface in places, creating pockmarks and channels where acidic runoff had carved irregular patterns into the metal. The opening through which I had fallen seemed impossibly distant, a rectangle of dim light that mocked my trapped condition. As my eyes adjusted to the perpetual twilight of the pit, details emerged that made my situation even more horrifying. The bodies around me bore fresh surgical incisions that had been made with the same precision I had observed at the murder scenes above. Someone had been conducting systematic experiments on the pit's occupants, using them as test subjects for procedures that served no medical purpose. The surgical cuts followed patterns that seemed designed to maximize pain while avoiding immediate death. Shallow incisions traced geometric designs across exposed skin, while deeper cuts had been made to access internal organs without causing fatal damage. The killer had been refining his techniques on these helpless victims, perfecting the methods he would later employ in his elaborate artistic murders. Medical equipment lined the walls at regular intervals, carefully organized and maintained despite the hellish conditions. Surgical instruments hung from hooks and brackets that had been welded directly to the metal surfaces, each tool positioned for easy access during the killer's experimental procedures. The organization demonstrated the same obsessive attention to detail that characterized the murder scenes, suggesting this underground laboratory had been operating for months or possibly years. The pit's occupants showed varying stages of surgical modification and disease progression. Some bore recent incisions that were still bleeding, while others displayed older wounds that had become infected and gangrenous. The killer had been documenting the healing process and infection patterns, using the trapped victims as living specimens for long-term observation studies. I attempted to climb toward one of the drainage pipes that entered the pit near its upper edge, using the diseased bodies as stepping stones in my desperate ascent. The flesh beneath my boots gave way with sickening squelches, and hands reached up to grasp at my armor with the desperate strength of the dying. The victims were not actively hostile, but their involuntary movements and grasping reflexes made progress nearly impossible. The drainage pipe proved to be a dead end, its opening blocked by years of accumulated debris and chemical deposits. The killer had apparently explored every potential escape route and sealed them systematically, transforming the pit into an inescapable prison for his experimental subjects. The blocked pipes and sealed maintenance shafts created a closed system where the trapped victims could be studied and manipulated without any possibility of escape. My rebreather finally failed completely, forcing me to breathe the contaminated air directly. The atmosphere was thick with airborne pathogens and chemical vapors that burned my lungs and throat with each breath. The diseased occupants were coughing constantly, spraying infected droplets into the already toxic air, and ensuring that anyone trapped in the pit would quickly succumb to the various plagues and infections that ravaged their bodies. The killer's voice drifted down from the opening above, though the words were distorted by distance and the acoustic properties of the metal chamber. The tone remained conversational and calm, as if discussing academic research rather than systematic torture and murder. The killer was apparently explaining his methodology and findings, treating me as an audience for his scientific observations rather than a victim to be eliminated. The surgical modifications on the pit's occupants followed a clear progression of experimentation and refinement. Early subjects showed crude incisions and amateur technique, while more recent victims displayed the surgical precision that characterized the artistic murders above. The killer had been learning and improving his skills through systematic practice on the trapped and helpless residents of the pit. Some victims bore evidence of repeated procedures, their bodies covered in layers of scars from multiple surgical sessions. The killer had been keeping detailed records of each subject's responses to different types of trauma, documenting pain thresholds and psychological breaking points with scientific thoroughness. The experiment served no medical purpose beyond satisfying the killer's curiosity about human suffering and endurance. I discovered a section of the pit where the bodies were arranged more systematically, positioned to provide optimal access for surgical procedures. The killer had created a makeshift operating theater using salvaged medical equipment and improvised restraints. Fresh blood stains on the metal surfaces indicated recent use, suggesting the killer continued to conduct experiments even while pursuing his elaborate artistic murders in the upper levels. The trapped victims displayed a horrifying variety of diseases and conditions that made them ideal subjects for the killer's research. Industrial workers suffered from chemical burns and respiratory damage caused by exposure to toxic substances. Plague victims showed the progressive stages of various infections that periodically swept through the Underhive's overcrowded communities. Others bore the distinctive markings of genetic disorders and congenital conditions that were common among the Underhive's inbred population. My attempts to find alternative escape routes led me through different sections of the pit, each one revealing new horrors and evidence of the killer's systematic approach to human experimentation. Drainage tunnels had been deliberately collapsed to prevent escape, while maintenance shafts had been filled with debris and chemical waste. The killer had spent considerable time and effort ensuring that anyone who fell into the pit would remain trapped indefinitely. The medical equipment positioned throughout the pit included instruments I had never seen before, specialized tools that appeared to be custom made for specific types of surgical procedures. The killer had apparently been developing new techniques and methods for inflicting precise types of trauma, creating instruments designed to maximize suffering while maintaining subject viability for extended periods. Some sections of the pit contained victims who had been subjected to experimental procedures that defied medical logic or purpose. Bodies bore incisions that followed no anatomical guidelines, cuts that seemed designed purely to explore the limits of human pain tolerance. The killer was treating the trapped subjects as raw material for artistic expression, using their flesh as a canvas for increasingly elaborate and sadistic designs. The systematic nature of the experiments became clear as I explored different areas of the pit. The killer had been documenting every procedure, maintaining detailed records of subject responses and physiological changes. Crude medical charts hung from the walls, covered in notes and observations written in a precise hand that matched the surgical technique displayed on the victims' bodies. The pit's occupants had been sorted and categorized according to their diseases and physical characteristics, with different sections containing subjects selected for specific types of experimentation. The killer had been conducting comparative studies, testing different surgical techniques on similar subjects to measure their relative effectiveness in producing desired responses. I found evidence that the killer had been refining techniques for prolonging consciousness during surgical procedures, developing methods for maintaining subject awareness while conducting increasingly invasive operations. The experiments had progressed from simple pain tolerance studies to complex investigations of psychological breaking points and trauma responses. The trapped victims showed signs of having been kept alive far longer than their conditions should have permitted, sustained through medical intervention that served only to prolong their suffering. The killer had been using advanced life support techniques to maintain subjects for extended experimentation periods, ensuring that each victim could contribute maximum data to his research before finally succumbing to their injuries and diseases. My exploration of the pit revealed additional chambers connected by narrow passages that had been carved through the metal walls. The killer had expanded the original space into a complex laboratory facility, creating specialized areas for different types of experimentation and observation. Each chamber contained its own collection of trapped subjects and surgical equipment, suggesting the scope of the operation was far larger than I had initially realized. The narrow passages between chambers forced me to crawl through spaces barely wide enough for my armored form, the contaminated surfaces scraping against my carapace as I squeezed through openings carved with deliberate precision. Each tunnel led to another chamber filled with trapped victims, creating a sprawling network of interconnected laboratories that extended far beyond what I had initially discovered. The killer had spent years constructing this underground facility, carving through metal walls and installing the infrastructure necessary to support his extensive research operations. The second chamber I entered contained victims arranged in rows like specimens in a medical museum, each body positioned to display specific surgical modifications and experimental procedures. The killer had been conducting systematic studies of human anatomy, exploring the effects of different types of trauma on various organ systems and physiological processes. Fresh incisions marked recent work, while older scars showed the progression of healing and infection patterns over extended periods. The medical equipment in this chamber was more sophisticated than what I had observed in the main pit, including devices I recognized as life support systems that had been modified for experimental purposes. The killer had been using advanced techniques to maintain subjects in states of prolonged consciousness, ensuring they remained aware throughout procedures that would normally result in shock or death. The modifications to standard medical equipment showed both technical expertise and complete disregard for any ethical considerations. I discovered detailed documentation of each experimental procedure, with charts and notes covering every wall surface in the chamber. The killer had been maintaining meticulous records of subject responses, physiological changes, and psychological reactions to different types of surgical intervention. The handwriting was precise and clinical, treating human suffering as data points in an ongoing research project that served no purpose beyond satisfying the killer's curiosity about pain and endurance. The third chamber revealed the true scope of the killer's activities, containing dozens of victims who had been subjected to increasingly elaborate surgical modifications. The killer had been using the trapped subjects to perfect techniques that would later be employed in the artistic murders that had initially drawn my attention. Each body showed evidence of procedures that pushed the boundaries of what human physiology could endure while maintaining consciousness and awareness. The progression of experimental techniques was clearly visible as I moved through different sections of the chamber. Early subjects showed crude and amateur surgical work, while more recent victims displayed the precision and artistry that characterized the murders in the upper levels. The killer had been learning and refining his methods through systematic practice on helpless subjects, treating their bodies as training materials for his increasingly sophisticated artistic vision. Some victims bore evidence of procedures that had been repeated multiple times, their bodies covered in layers of scars from surgical sessions conducted over periods of weeks or months. The killer had been studying the long-term effects of different types of trauma, documenting how subjects responded to repeated procedures and progressive escalation of surgical intervention. The experiment served no medical purpose beyond advancing the killer's understanding of human suffering and the limits of physical endurance. The fourth chamber contained what could only be described as the killer's masterpieces, subjects who had been transformed through surgical modification into living sculptures that displayed the full extent of his artistic vision. The procedures performed on these victims surpassed anything I had encountered in the Upper Hive murders, representing years of practice and refinement that had culminated in works of horrifying beauty and technical precision. Each masterpiece showed different aspects of the killer's evolving artistic philosophy, with surgical modifications that created the illusion of movement and flow across the surface of living flesh. The cuts were arranged in complex patterns that seemed to shift and change when viewed from different angles, demonstrating not just medical knowledge, but also sophisticated understanding of visual composition and artistic technique. The killer had been using these living sculptures as inspiration for his work in the upper levels, testing different design concepts and technical approaches on the trapped subjects before implementing them in the more visible murders that had attracted imperial attention. The underground facility served as both laboratory and gallery, allowing the killer to refine his methods while maintaining a permanent collection of his most successful creations. I found evidence that the killer had been expanding his operations, with construction work visible in several areas where new chambers were being carved from the surrounding metal structures. The facility was growing larger and more sophisticated, suggesting the killer intended to continue his research indefinitely while using the upper hive murders to attract new subjects for his experiments. The fifth chamber revealed the killer's true identity and background, containing personal effects and documentation that had been carefully preserved despite the facility's harsh conditions. The killer was indeed a former medique named Valerius Kine, who had lost his credentials following unauthorized experimentation on patients in an upper hive medical facility. The official records showed a brilliant surgeon whose career had been destroyed by allegations of unethical research and patient abuse. Kine had fled to the underhive following his disgrace, using his medical knowledge and surgical skills to establish this hidden laboratory where he could continue his research without imperial oversight or ethical constraints. The facility represented years of careful planning and construction, with every detail designed to support his ongoing experiments while remaining completely hidden from outside detection. The documentation revealed that Kine viewed his work as legitimate medical research that had been unfairly suppressed by imperial bureaucracy and professional jealousy. His notes described the trapped subjects as volunteers who were contributing to important scientific advancement, completely ignoring the fact that they were helpless victims who had been condemned to prolonged torture for his personal gratification. The killer's delusional rationalization of his activities was evident throughout his written records, which described elaborate surgical procedures as artistic achievements rather than acts of systematic torture. Kine had convinced himself that his work represented a higher form of medical art that transcended conventional ethical boundaries and professional limitations. I discovered that Kine had been using the upper hive murders as recruitment tools, selecting victims whose physical characteristics would be useful for specific experimental procedures. The artistic elements of those murders were secondary to their practical purpose of providing fresh subjects for his underground research facility. Each visible murder had been carefully planned to attract investigative attention while concealing the true scope of his operations. The killer had been monitoring my investigation from the beginning, using informants and surveillance to track my progress while ensuring I would eventually be led to this location. The entire pursuit had been orchestrated to bring me here, where I would become another subject for his experimental procedures. My capture had been planned as carefully as every other aspect of his research program. The sixth chamber contained the killer's most recent work, subjects who showed the full evolution of his surgical techniques and artistic vision. These victims had been transformed into living displays that showcased years of practice and refinement, their bodies serving as permanent exhibitions of the killer's developing skills and aesthetic philosophy. Kine had been using these subjects to explore the boundaries between surgery and art, creating modifications that served no medical purpose beyond demonstrating his technical capabilities and creative vision. The procedures were designed to maximize both visual impact and subject suffering, ensuring that each creation would serve as both artistic achievement and research data. The systematic arrangement of subjects throughout the chamber showed that Kine viewed his work as a legitimate gallery worthy of preservation and study. Each victim had been positioned to provide optimal viewing angles, with lighting and display elements that enhanced the visual impact of the surgical modifications. The killer had created a museum of human suffering that existed solely for his own aesthetic appreciation. I realized that my investigation had been leading me toward becoming the centerpiece of Kine's collection, a final masterpiece that would represent the culmination of his artistic and scientific development. The killer had been planning my capture and transformation from the moment I began investigating the upper hive murders, viewing me as ideal raw material for his most ambitious project. The sound of footsteps echoed through the facility as Kine descended into his underground laboratory, carrying medical equipment and supplies for the procedures he intended to perform on his newest subject. The killer moved through the chambers with the confidence of someone completely familiar with every detail of the facility's layout and the condition of each trapped victim. Kine appeared in the chamber where I was trapped, carrying a surgical case that contained the same high-quality instruments I had observed at the murder scenes above. The killer had maintained his equipment with professional care despite the facility's harsh conditions, ensuring that each tool remained sharp and sterile for the precise work that characterized his artistic vision. The killer began preparing for the surgical procedures that would transform me into another permanent display in his underground gallery, arranging instruments and positioning lighting with the same methodical approach that had characterized his previous work. Kind treated the preparation as a sacred ritual, taking time to ensure that every detail was perfect before beginning the actual surgical modifications. I watched helplessly as the killer made his final preparations, knowing that I would soon join the dozens of other victims who served as living exhibitions in his gallery of human suffering. The investigation that had begun with simple murders in the upper hive had led me to discover a horror that surpassed anything in my years as an arbitrator, a systematic program of torture and experimentation that had been conducted in secret for years. The killer's voice filled the chamber as he explained his artistic philosophy and research methodology, treating me as an audience for his theories about the relationship between surgery and art. Kind described his work as a legitimate form of medical research that pushed the boundaries of conventional practice, completely ignoring the fact that his subjects were unwilling victims rather than voluntary participants. As the surgical procedures began, I realized that I would become another permanent resident of Kind's underground facility, conscious but unable to escape, forced to witness the arrival of new victims who would continue the endless cycle of calculated suffering that the killer had established in his hidden laboratory beneath the Underhive's forgotten sectors. The killer worked with the same precision and artistry that had characterized his previous creations, transforming my body into another living sculpture that would serve as both artistic achievement and research specimen. The procedures were designed to maintain consciousness while creating the visual effects that satisfied Kind's aesthetic vision, ensuring that I would remain aware of my condition while serving as a permanent display in his gallery of human suffering. The investigation had ended not with justice or resolution, but with my transformation into another exhibit in the killer's collection, trapped forever in the underground facility where Kind continued his research while new victims arrived to feed his insatiable appetite for human experimentation and artistic expression. The Underhive's forgotten sectors would continue to hide this horror from Imperial detection, allowing the killer to pursue his work indefinitely, while the gallery of living sculptures grew larger with each passing day.